telling us, basically. So we're wondering, how do we transform theological education? Not just content, not just subject matter, but the way in which we are learning. And we're all seeing through a glass darkly, and there are a few experiments here and there, including here at Church of All Nations, but we feel like the crisis is so urgent that we have to share what little we know, what little insights we have, and also be schooled by experiments that have been going on for decades. And we recognize that even some of our more innovative experiments right now would not be where it is without the learning and the wisdom gleaned from the experiments from decades ago. And we are so blessed to have some people here on our panel with that kind of experience and who continue to do the work of theological and Christian leadership formation. And then after each of the presenter speaks for about 10 minutes, we want to open it up and see what questions and what urgencies we have as we consider these matters. May I ask, how many of us here have some formal theological educational background? Oh my goodness. No wonder you're here. It's a room full of nerds. Well, actually, this is the right group then. I mean, we understand what's at stake. So we're really, really grateful that you've taken a Thursday evening to be with us to share in this dialogue. We're so grateful to our leaders. And I think I didn't frame it fully. I'm sorry about that. But I think it will... You'll see it emerge as each of the presenters speak and as we engage the whole room here. So I'm going to turn it to the two other co-founders of Underground Seminary, Laura first and then John.
Well, I think we'll have our panelists come forward. We have the privilege of introducing them. So Barbara, if you want to come up, and Pastor Jin, Chad and Michael. Jin Kim, who you just heard, is founding pastor of Church of All Nations and most recently founder of Underground Seminary, an alternative form of theological education that focuses on decolonizing Christian leadership. He writes and speaks widely on the ministry of reconciliation in a post-colonial, post-supremacist world. We have Barbara Holmes here. Barbara is the president of United Theological Seminary of the Twin Cities, which is just about a half a mile down the road from here, as well as a professor of ethics and African American religious studies. She's an ordained minister recognized in the Disciples of Christ. Dr. Holmes is also a writer and scholar who publishes books about the intersection of ethics, spirituality, mysticism, cosmology, and African American religious culture.
And I'm John. It's my privilege to introduce both Chad and Michael Ray Matthews. Chad Myers is a fifth-generation Californian. He is an activist theologian, a biblical scholar, a popular educator, an author, organizer, and advocate who has for 35 years been challenging and supporting Christians to engage in peace and justice work and radical discipleship. He's also been a leading voice in this conversation of alternative theological education through his work co-founding Word and World and also Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries, along with a number of other initiatives. And Michael Ray Matthews is the director of clergy organizing for PICO National Network. A number of us are familiar with Isaiah here in the Twin Cities, are involved with it. They're an affiliate of PICO, which is where I've had the privilege to bump into Michael Ray a number of times. That is a faith-based network of over 1,200 congregations engaged in community organizing in over 200 cities in the United States. He leads what is now the Theology of Prophetic Resistance, is that correct, initiative, aimed at shaping the movement for racial and economic inclusion in the U.S., and he recently co-led a delegation of clergy at the Vatican to discuss racial justice issues. So would you join me in welcoming our panelists as we begin this conversation? And we've asked them to start out by sharing for 10 minutes or so some thoughts on the topics at hand, but especially speaking out of their experience, their location, the work that they're doing, about what they see lacking right now, responding to some of the issues that Pastor Jin raised and others that will emerge, and conventional theological education, and what can be done differently. How would you equip Christian leaders if you could start from scratch today? So, somebody like to begin?
Good evening. I'll start with the first question. And the question is about whether or not something is lacking in theological education. And underlying the question is the presumption that the seminaries are not doing something right. And what I want us to get our heads around is they're doing exactly what they were founded to do. There's nothing wrong there, except for relevance, except for... They're doing what we wanted them to do, training dominant culture people for dominant culture churches. We're training them for the elitist professional ministry. We're training them to be spokespersons for divine mystery, if that makes any sense to anybody here. So my feeling is that seminaries are just another tributary on the march from kindergarten to death. Starting in kindergarten, they start lining you up, and they start telling you where you sit and what you, when you can talk and how you can talk by raising your hand, and when you can eat and what you can do. And it continues all through your education. And what they're basically doing is preparing you to be submissive to authority. They are preparing you for conformity. They are helping you to understand how you should accept class, race, gender, ethnicity, and the assignments. And we're supposed to believe that what they have assigned to other people, quote unquote, is inevitable. So from a very early age, we are hypnotized into a slumber, only we don't know that we're not awake. So if you don't know you're not awake, you're not even concerned about what's going on. Make no mistake about it, we are trained to serve the powers that be, using Walter Wink's language. And make no mistake about it, the church is a power. Its liturgical paradigms are used by the powers to support the domination systems. And there is another way. The other thing the seminaries do is create insider outsiders. They prepare people to be insiders who speak a particular language to a particular group of people. And it creates a perennial discomfort with difference. So we need a paradigm shift. And I don't know if you know who Grace Lee Boggs is, but activists, yes, Ashe. Most of us here have had the opportunity to sit at her feet, 100-year-old Chinese immigrant, PhD scholar, activist in Detroit, passed away on Monday. And this is what she said. She said, "We urgently need a paradigm shift. We need to leave behind the concept of education as a passport to more money and higher status in the future, and replace it with the concept of education as an ongoing process. We need to enlist the energies and creativity of the next generation." Grace said, "It's time for us to rebuild and re-spirit our communities." And I'm going to stop there, and we'll have more discussion later.
And she's the seminary president on the panel. How do you think this thing's going to go? First of all, it's just great to have this chance to have a conversation. And those of you who are further back in the pews, if you want to move up to make it a little bit more intimate, I think the hope is that this will be a conversation. But to be surrounded by these colleagues here, some old friends and new friends, is a real privilege. Thank you to Church of All Nations for convening this on this great weekend that we have in store for us. Thanks to Barbara for opening the door, or shall I say kicking down the door of the conversation to get us started. To kind of underline some of what President Holmes has already talked about, it is important that we have an analysis of what the problem is as we try to imagine alternatives and solutions. And obviously, we can point to three major areas of struggle in theological education. That is how theology is studied, where theology is studied, and what kind of theology is studied. How theology is studied, the methodology is, the pedagogy is important. It's been now, 50 years since Paulo Freire introduced the perspective of popular education. And the pedagogical practices that continue to prevail in North American seminaries still tend to be the sort of dependence breeding banking system of knowledge that privilege content over process and nurture intellectualizing rather than praxis. Where theology is studied is also true. As Robert pointed out, seminaries are doing what they were sort of engineered to do, and the deep predicate for modern theological study is the monastic model of cloistered, insulated reflection. So the social location of most seminaries make them accessible really only to educated middle-class persons and relatively remote from the life of the community, particularly the poor, and also well-insulated from social movements. So that kind of fortress, that ancient fortress mentality of the monastery continues to prevail. Whether or not you're an urban or suburban, there's still sort of an economic ring around tertiary education in general, and seminaries in particular. So that's an issue. Obviously, what kind of theology is being talked about is important. Particularly, I think, in the North American context, seminary curricula are just now beginning to address the whole range of practical skills actually needed for contemporary ministry. It's good to learn preaching, pastoring, and theology, but community organizing, social analysis, communication skills, nonprofit administration, are all things that really are as important or more important in actually being a functional church. But underlying all of these things really, in my mind, is the ideology of professionalism that Dr. Holmes has alluded to here. The production of knowledge has become a standardized commodity in the modern university, steadily displacing the older ethos of apprenticeships and guilds with that of credentialing monopolies. And the three main components of this ideology of professionalism in education is individualism, elitism, and a psychology of entitlement. And this drift really has only intensified over the last decade because of the way that, or really the last quarter century, because of the way that North American tertiary educational institutions have been impacted by neoliberal economic and political forces. It's not too much to talk about the structural adjustment of tertiary education, particularly in the United States, because we see all of the trends that are characteristic of neoliberal adjustments. Privatization, so increasing university seminary dependence upon corporate financing for endowments, infrastructure, and research grants. Indebtedness, don't need to talk to any of the people who've been in the system recently to know that one of the big differences between now and 50 years ago when some of us did our education is the what you walk out of in terms of the debt burden. And that debt burden really acts as a disincentive to the student to do extracurricular activities like serve in a soup kitchen or go on an internship or spend time at a third world seminary or whatever it might be, do community organizing, because you want to get in, you want to get out to keep your debt balance sheet as low as possible. And finally, the value of competition, the sort of meritocratic struggle for resources and or professional prestige that pits students, departments, and institutions against each other and tend to undermine collaborative learning, research, and writing. Now that's, I'm talking about, in general, university education in the United States. It's moving further away from traditional liberal notions of a community of critical scholarship and toward a kind of economic rationalism that sees the institution as a degree factory for managerial, technocratic, and academic classes. Now the problem is that seminaries in the last 50 years have been moving closer to the university model and further away from their organic relationship with churches and ecclesial movements. And that is what is, I think, particularly alarming for those of us who understand that church is at its best when it is a social movement for transformation, both personal and political. So the forces of elitism and structural adjustment have taken seminary culture steadily in the direction of the university, and oftentimes seminaries are trying to stand before the bar of university values and credentialing requirements and so on. And those old sort of pre-modern churchly values of that value the communal over the private, or the economics of gift and grace over those of debt and merit, or practices of cooperation and consociation over those of competition and individualism, those are the things that tend to get traded off in this. So this has been a drift. We've been really moving in this direction for at least a half a century, if not more, arguably. And I just think we need to kind of see this as these structural forces at work as we then ask, okay, so what do we do about it? And I agree with Dr. Holmes that the problem isn't, well, we got to figure out how to populate our seminaries because they're dwindling and they've got to survive. We've got to ask much deeper questions, and that is fundamentally, what is theological education supposed to be about? Like everybody here on the panel, I'm mostly interested in figuring out alternatives, and I'm hoping that we'll talk about that as we go. But I do want to just note that in the same way that modern neoliberalism controls capital and sucks up capital, so those of us trying at the grassroots to build alternative theological expressions find ourselves very challenged to access resources to do that, because certainly most of the institutional money and a lot of the discretionary donor dollars are really tied up just trying to prop up the existing seminaries. And so there's oftentimes an unwitting competition between grassroots alternatives and the institutions who are in a waning cycle but still trying to keep themselves going. So it's just wonderful to be up here with a pastor, a seminary president, a community organizer, and whatever I am, to have this conversation about how we rebuild theological education, as we say in our work, in the space in between the seminary, the sanctuary, the street, and the soil. And with that, I'll pass it over to Michael Wright.
Good evening. It's good to be here. I'm grateful that I survived last night and could be here. I had food poisoning last night, and I thought I wasn't going to make it, so I'm really pleased to be here. I'm really sorry also that I won't be here for the entire weekend. Jill Scott's in concert tomorrow in California. And it's not that I want to see her, it's that my wife wants me to be sitting next to her when she sees her.
All right.
So I'm grateful to just get a little bit of this conversation and also to participate in it. So this question about theological education and what's lacking makes me think about my own journey as a seminarian over 20 years ago when I moved from Los Angeles to Berkeley to go to seminary. And I went to seminary with a very clear understanding that I would never be a pastor of a congregation. Never. Can you tell that I wasn't right on that? And so I deliberately took courses that would not sort of be like, you know, the track for those who were going to serve in congregational leadership. I was clear that I would serve out of the church, but I would serve in the community as an outreach minister. And so I immediately started trying to find who all the sort of rebel professors were who were teaching the stuff that I really wanted to learn, that wasn't sort of the prescribed curriculum. Or who were teaching courses that sounded like the prescribed curriculum, but they were really being a little bit subversive in what they were teaching. And then I also got deeply involved with faith-based community organizing. And I think it was my experience running with organizers in West Oakland, in East Oakland, that helped me begin to understand how much pastors and congregations in Oakland were seeking for understanding about the experiences of their communities, and that for those who had pursued seminary education or who were pursuing it, in many ways the educational experience was not informing them in that way. And so in some ways, organizing became sort of my sort of supplemental theological education. There were ways in which I was exposed to an organizing things that we never talked about in my courses, in terms of simple things like how to build community, how to be in relationship with folks and forge relationship, how to uncover people's pain and hope and engage them in their own liberation. That's really what organizing is at the end of the day. And I fell in love with organizing because what I saw in organizing was a model for how the congregation could be in real relationship with the community around them, because they're actually required to talk to them, not just put signs outside. But I also saw a model for how the congregation could become a real community through the engagement of the organizing arts. And so the experience of organizing actually is what prepared me to say yes to a call to be a pastor. not so much my seminary education. And so I spent 8 years. I was in one church for 5 years, the one where I was exposed to organizing as an outreach minister, and then I went to serve as a pastor for 8 years in San Jose, California, and then I was sort of snatched up and poached by PICO to join their team. What I was really clear about, in addition to the community building and engaging folks in their liberation, was that there were things that you needed to understand if you're going to be effective in organizing that were not being taught in the seminaries, particularly understanding the operation of race and white dominance in our culture. Also, how the economy works. So there's a way in which we organize around dollars, like a very small amount of dollars that we want to get to fund things in our communities, and we have no idea where that money is coming from, how that money represents a small, small, small fraction of dollars that have already been allocated to other communities that are not ours, even though that money actually belongs in our communities. So understanding the economic process, the political process, and particularly if you worked in West Oakland, you need to be able to understand environmental racism and how young kids, young black and brown kids suffered in many ways because of what was happening in West Oakland. By the way, you should know that right now, one of the longest standing Methodist congregations in West Oakland is in trouble right now because new residents who have moved into West Oakland are complaining that they're singing gospel music on Sunday mornings. I just want to say that. So when I finished seminary, I also then worked for another seminary. A seminary with a tradition of being very progressive, being very welcoming of LGBT folks, taking a stand around that very early on. But it was also a place where I recognized the ways in which one can have a very clear position around inclusion, but may not have a very clear vision for how to make that work. And so my experience is that many in the academies, particularly where I studied, we're very clear about the structural analysis of race and racism and homophobia, but weren't clear about the connection between the inner and intrapersonal dimensions of those isms. I think one more thing I want to say before I pass this on is that I think in a bit I'll talk about PICO, but before I talk, before we circle back around to that, one of the questions that I've been wrestling with in my work with clergy in the PICO network is this question about how we prepare them for leadership in this work when the seminary has not necessarily prepared them for it. And the Theology of Resistance project that I'm leading now is really right now aimed at trying to find ways of supplementing the experience of not only seminary trained folks, but even folks who did not have seminary education, to begin to help them think about and understand how our economy works, understand the operation of race in our culture, and begin to figure out how it is that they can really be prophets of the resistance rather than chaplains of the empire. And I think in many ways, our seminary education experience trained us to be chaplains to the empire. And even our churches themselves almost call us to emulate a way of being in the world that leads us to be simply chaplains to the empire.
Although it appears that I am head and shoulders above my colleagues, the truth is, most of the furniture in our church are donated, and we only had three of those matching chairs. And because of my humble nature, I chose a least comfortable chair, so please do not judge me. This forum came out of just one-on-one conversations I had with these three amazing folks. I'm so rich. I mean, I get to count people like Barbara, Chet, and Michael Ray as friends and colleagues. There's no greater wealth than to have people like these in your life. Barbara became president of United Seminary, which is just a half mile from here. We're neighbors. And she and the dean of faculty reached out, and we had a nice lunch nearby. And through that conversation, we found out that Barbara and Ched were doing radical theological educational experiments together in the 1980s. Yeah, before I was born. Yes. Yes. Anyway, I'm not good at math. And Chet has been such an important mentor to many of us here at Church of All Nations. And I didn't know that he was a mentor to Walter Brueggemann, who was a very important mentor of mine. And then through our work with Isaiah, our church is very active with Isaiah, a community organizing church-based group here in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. We got to meet Mike Ray at a number of events. And these conversations just led to us asking about the shape of theological education in the future. And when we were going to do this conference, we thought it would be a great way to just have this conversation be a part of that. So I'm personally deeply grateful for their willingness to be here and honor us with their presence. I agree with what Michael Ray just said, that it seems like our conventional theological education, whether it be conservative or mainline or liberal, I mean, like, do those distinctions really make that much difference these days, is really equipping future Christian leaders to help the people cope with the effects of empire. So ministry is basically coping. Surely there's a role for that, but is that all that the Bible offers? Is that all that the power and the spirit of Jesus can do? Is that the only thing that our God, Yahweh, is offering us? It's a number of coping mechanisms. But when we don't challenge the very foundations of an imperial society, then all we have is coping, and that just seems so flimsy. I've been a pastor for 22 years, and here are the effects of empire I see in my people. And the closer they are to the imperial center, typically white Americans, but just remember that whiteness is a condition, it is a disease, and lots of people have it, like Latino governors and black Supreme Court justices and aspiring Korean immigrants who have become very adept at eating the crumbs of white privilege and getting ahead with these amazing smartphones. So what are the effects of whiteness? And white supremacy I describe as the primary and fundamental strategy of the American imperial experiment. You know, the Chinese Empire had their strategies, the Russian Empire theirs, the British Empire theirs. But the American Empire is really unique because it is a kind of a hodgepodge of European immigrants who hated each other back in their home countries. I mean, like, what do the French and the Germans have to do with each other? The French and the English and the Italians and the Russians. I mean, like, these people hated each other and were at war with each other for hundreds, even thousands of years. And then they come to America and decide to become American and decide to mix up the gene pool and be white, whatever that means. It's a really flimsy thing, you know? Like, what is white culture? Materialism, is that a culture? So it's really sad and thin, but it's something that has been sold around the world politically, economically, militarily, and most insidiously, culturally, Hollywood and the rest, as the height of human civilization, which is crazy. We're all crazy. Nuts. NVTS, nuts. That's nuts in Latin. That's from an old Mel Brooks routine. Anyway, so what are the effects of empire in my people? And as I said, whiteness kind of, the more white they are, regardless of their ethnic background, the closer they are to the imperial ideological center. How about fear, anxiety, self-consciousness? Boy, that's a big one. Seriousness. Imperial people are so serious. And basically hopelessly narcissistic. As if, like, our tiny little lives matter. You know, like, there are 7 billion of us on this earth. And I say to my people on a regular basis, because they are so caught up in the anxiety of empire, very few people cared when you were born. Very few people will care when you die. You will have had very little, no difference basically in your life. And even if you do make a difference, people will forget in a matter of years, if not days. So no matter how great we do, or podcasts or books or whatever we leave behind, you know, most people are just busy doing their own thing and trying to get by. So our desire to leave some kind of legacy is an imperial pipe dream. That's the carrot that empire offers to us, that we can be important, even though that is just ridiculous. How are you going to be important, you know, with 7 billion people around and everybody trying to be important? This desire to be special is itself one of the lies of imperial ideology. So one of the reasons that we started Underground Seminary here is that our church had an internship program, and we actually worked formally with a number of seminaries in the Twin Cities, and with, like, Princeton Seminary, where I went to school, at Columbia Seminary, and Fuller, and we actually had some formal arrangements, and mostly it was just filling out forms. I cannot believe how many forms I had to fill out. and evaluations and surveys and meetings. And after one semester or two, I mean, I'm not sure what exactly we accomplished. So we decided to go offline in terms of working formally with seminaries and take seminary graduates and just say, you're going to be done when our congregation says you're done, but you can leave at any time. But if you want to be like done our way, then who knows how long it'll take. And we thought going offline, it would take about a year and a half at most. We realized over the years, it took a year and a half to just kind of deprogram our people from the kind of things that that Barbara and Chet are talking about. This sense of professionalism, upward mobility, and more having to move into a professional status just to pay off debt, right? Even if people have more earthy ideas of ministry, just can't do it with $20,000, $30,000, $50,000, $60,000 in debt. So we asked the question, how do we provide serious theological education that also heal the body from the effects of empire? You know, empire is not just something in the mind. It's something at the molecular level. When we are anxious all the time, that is a disease that cannot be uprooted no matter how many hundreds of books we read and seminars we go to and conferences we attend. We basically have to die to the imperial impulse in us and be born again into the reign of God, which is not anxious. There is no anxiety in God's presence. So we can be as radical as we want in our commitment, but our bodies do not lie. It's our bodies that give us away. It's our nervousness, our shaking, our tics, all the things that we convey that we don't see in a low context cultural environment like the West, but that, you know, everybody from all the other parts of the world where body language is important. It's so obvious. It's embarrassingly obvious. And I think that's why white people have to hang around other white people so much, because it is so obviously, starkly revealing just how neurotic we are. We have to hide that neurosis by being with other like-minded neurotics, right? So this is what we're wrestling with. It's like, how do we de-neuroticize, de-imperialize whitewashed bodies so that we can embody the peace, the calm, the confidence that God is God and human empires are shit, right? But the closer we are to the imperial center, the more we fear empire. And even if we stand up to it, it's more bravado than the kind of non-anxious, differentiated presence that Jesus embodied, you know? Jesus was not like, I'm not afraid of you, here's my sword, and I'm going to cut off the ear of a Roman soldier. You know, that's what one of his disciples did, Peter. But Jesus did not need a fight like that. Jesus was bigger than the Roman Empire. Do you get what I'm saying? Jesus, just a nobody Jewish dude from no good town of Nazareth, knew he was bigger than all of the Roman Empire. How do we do theological education and Christian formation where ordinary people like us look down on the pathetic empires of our day and all the days since, what, about 10,000 years, the rise of civilization and all that, and just say, this too shall pass. This looks like a mountain, and we can cast it into the sea. Jesus cast the Roman Empire into the sea, right? He didn't say when, but it happened. And whether it's an American empire or a future Korean empire, anytime a few human beings think that they're God and conglomerate money and resources and people to make something for themselves, that tower will be thrown down, that temple will come to naught. We're trying to raise up people who not only have an analysis, but a disposition, a patronizing disposition toward empire, and say the worst you can do is imprison me, torture me, and kill me. But I'm one of 7 billion people. So easy come, easy go. When we do not fear empire, then we embody the reign of God. That's what we're trying to do at Underground Seminary. Will we succeed? Stay tuned.
Before we move into some Q&A, I wonder if the four of you might spend just a few minutes talking about experiments that you're a part of now or have been in the past to do theological education a little bit differently.
When I first started speaking, I looked up at the camera a representation sometimes of the domination systems, enough to say, be careful of what you say, it's being recorded. And my primary job is as a fundraiser. But what I learned a long time ago is that if you are afraid, you are useless. You must stand up against what you know is wrong and speak truth to power at all times, even when it's recorded. So, so here we go, yeah. I'm not sure we can fix what has been built called seminary. And I'm not sure we can take it apart. So what I'm doing is innovating around the core. I can't change the core because the system has in place accreditation. And I'm going into my fourth year and I have never had a semester where I didn't have major accreditors coming, visiting, telling me how I had to do things. Back during the Bush years, they put in, after No Child Left Behind, all of these systems to quantify the unquantifiable, to measure the unmeasurable, and to prove it over and over and over again. A lot of our resources go to that. And so we have to leave that little core. It will either work or it won't. And around it, what we're doing is partnerships and client-based services. So for partnerships, I would give you as an example the program we're going to be doing with rookie police officers. A consultant came in and asked me why I wasn't working with the police. And I said, because I don't like them very much. Amen. I have two black sons, and they have to keep their hands at 10 and 2 and not look them in the eye. So what do you want me to do about them? And he said, I'm not a Christian, but you claim to be. And this is a what kind of seminary? And I thought, okay. So we began talking to police officers, and what we've decided is that we can't do anything with seasoned police officers, but we can work with rookie cops. Because rookie police officers come in wanting to help people, and then something happens. And so there is a program that the Justice Department may or may not support, but we're going at it anyway. The Black Church is in it. Our seminary is in it. We're going to immerse these rookie cops in neighborhoods they've never been in a different way. They're going to visit with the moms. They're going to go to mosques. They're going to play with Sufis. They're going to do things they don't do. We're going to bring some of the teenagers out of these communities, besiege communities, and have them ride with cops and see the other side, not to change either side, but to keep them from telling these narratives that are not true about one another. So that's a partnership. So you got the core, you got the partnership. The other thing we're doing is client-based services and expanding our liberalism to include people that we don't necessarily like or agree with. My seminary is radically progressive, white, feminist, LGBT, all of that. And when I came to it, I said, this is the same kind of shibboleth setting aside to yourselves as the conservatives are doing. You're just doing it in a different way. So if you're going to be inclusive, you have to include people you don't agree with. So I opened a school downtown called Twin Cities School of Theology. Right now, it primarily serves post-evangelicals. We're all post-something. The posties say they are socially relevant, agree with justice issues, but read the Bible more conservatively. That's okay with me. So they go to school there. They prefer to go to school there. the other client-based services that I have had imams come to me and ask me to teach them pastoral care. I didn't say out loud, you can't preach either, but okay, let's start with pastoral care. So we are planning a program to help them serve their people better in their way, in their mosques, in their territory. We don't have to be on my campus. We don't have to do it my way. What we need to do is become fluent in other cultures' languages if we're going to teach seminary or theological education in a meaningful way. You know, there are drumming circles, and there are wise Gullah women who were in my family who intuit and teach discernment. Pastors could do with a little more discernment and intuition. Why do we have to teach theological education only in a Eurocentric model?
Just a couple things to sort of set that up. So on the one hand, I said that community organizing was sort of this sort of supplemental experience for me in my theological education. And at the same time, especially after 20 years of being a leader in the PICO network, I'm very clear about the ways in which it is too a product of empire. And that it is part of a nonprofit industrial complex that depends on major national funders to get its work done, and that in many ways is still recovering from a way of understanding organizing that was designed, you know, by a very sort of male-dominated, white-dominated way of thinking of communities and relationships and power, and so. One of the things that's happening in the life of the PICO network is that more and more of its leaders of color are raising more questions about our commitment to putting race at the center of our work. Our journey around race, in many ways, some would say that back in the old days we never talked about race in organizing. That if you talked about race, it would just divide people. And so what we would say is we work with those who are closest to the pain. In quotes, and that was our sort of code for working with darker skinned people. And then maybe about 15 years ago, as the network began to grow, it became more obvious among our staff that staff of color were just sort of circling in and out of our work and not staying while their white counterparts could, you know, have 10, 15, 20, 30 year careers. In this work. And so there's a lot of investment made in trying to improve the retention and advancement of staff of color. And so that was how we dealt with race about 15 years ago, was trying to begin to invest in diversity. And then our journey went to a place of paying much more attention than just to the diversity of staff, but to the reality of race in the actual issues we organize around. And Isaiah was a big help in this because their work with John Powell and others kind of set the stage for our folks to begin to pay attention to a racial analysis that needs to be a part of any organizing campaign. And so that was the big cool and hot thing for a long time in PICO, that we were learning how to look at race and understand race inside of the issues that we were working on. But even that movement was one that still allowed for us to sort of step back from the work and look and see how race shows up in terms of disparities and inequalities, but not recognize that ultimate justice requires that we pay attention to the healing of race that happens not only at structural levels, not only at cultural levels, but also at intra and interpersonal levels as well. And so today we find ourselves talking a lot about racial justice and how to really put race and racial justice and economic inclusion at the center of our work. Last year, some of our clergy and leaders from the PICO network were summoned by some of our partners in Missouri to go into Ferguson. And so within about a week after Mike Brown was killed, we were there on the ground. Some of us were in and out of Ferguson for about 4 months. The experience of those who not only went to Ferguson, but the experience of clergy all across the PICO network who were experiencing what the whole society was witnessing in Ferguson was one that was deeply disruptive and raised all kinds of questions. Clergy asking, what have we been doing for the past 10 years? How is it that we are at a place where we have generations of people who are in despair and have no relationship with the church? What does it mean that we've not been there for them? What does it mean that we've somehow let them down? And there's been a lot of talk about repentance among clergy in the aftermath of Ferguson. There's been a lot of talk about what does it mean for us to recalibrate and think again about what it means for us to be truly committed to the liberation of our people. And so this question about chaplains of the empire versus prophets of the resistance was very much born out of that experience and out of that disruption that happened in the hearts of so many clergy leaders in the PICO network and also elsewhere beyond PICO as well. And so in many ways, what we are trying to try on in this Theology of Resistance project is a way of recalibrating our work, creating more open source understandings of our organizing models, rethinking what it means for us to be clearly rooted in our faith, but also able to work with folks who may not be a part of faith institutions. When we look at the Black Lives Matter movement, it's very clear that there are folks who are leading that movement who were abandoned by the church and still get opposition from our churches, especially our Black churches. And so we are trying to create in that space a way of examining and creating safe spaces for clergy to rethink what it means to be in this movement and in this moment in ways that may not look like what they've been used to as faith leaders in their communities.
Could you maybe just say a little bit more about what those spaces look like that you're curating?
Well, so they don't start till January, but I'll tell you what my vision is. My vision is that we would be creating more and more spaces like there's a sort of a cohort model that we're looking at for this, where clergy are going to be not only in multi-faith, multicultural spaces, where they're going to be learning alongside other theologians, other folks who do a lot of education around economy, helping folks understand how Ferguson becomes Ferguson. But also working in spaces that are sort of intracultural as well, so that they're able to ask the questions that they're afraid to ask when they're in mixed company as well. A lot of evangelical clergy and Black clergy who have either considered organizing or have been involved in organizing really wrestle with how the theology that they've embraced does not have room for other expressions to show up. And so we have to create the space where they're practicing what it means to interact with others, others who are different than them, but also create the safe spaces for them to be in intracultural spaces where they can ask the questions that they think are going to be stupid questions. Yeah.
Thanks, Michael. As many of you know, I and some of the other folks here tonight have been involved over the last 15 years in a particular experiment called Word and World at People's School. And what we did was we tried to look at identify five strands of alternative pedagogy and practice in the North American experience. And that was, those five were the Freedom School tradition of the Black civil rights struggle, especially as it developed in the 60s, but both before that and after that. The underground seminary experiments of anti-war and radical discipleship movements, which drew consciously upon the confessing church tradition out of Nazi Germany. Thirdly, we looked at feminist pedagogies of the women's movement and struggles for inclusion among sexual minorities. We looked at the base community movements and the various practices of liberation theology, particularly on the ground in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. And we looked at the tradition of labor schools in the labor movement. And those streams not only influenced our thinking, but we actually, the first six or seven schools that we did tried to learn more about those streams as the focus of those schools, which began in 2002. Between 2002 and 2008, we had seven or eight schools, including one here in Minneapolis, which focused on the work of radical theologian William Stringfellow, who was neither clergy nor seminary professor. What we found in those experiments of convening irregular spaces was that to choose a populist over a seminary-based theological pedagogy, we had to figure out first how to operate with little or no institutional support, which prompted my colleague Bill Wiley Kellerman to refer to us wryly as the lumpen professoriat. our approach tended to be too practical for the seminaries, too political for the churches, and too evangelical for most activist or mainline liberal organizations. So we ended up being itinerant and sort of designed a floating alternative seminary, which was a little bit like a circus roadshow. Highly creative, highly improvisational, very rich, but also really difficult to sustain, particularly when you're doing it out of your own pocket. We employed pedagogy of popular education. So critical reflection was important, but so was singing and praying. And rereading scripture was important, but so was art and body work and liturgy. In our view, the standard of success would be measured by whether someone sitting in that space over a number of days would not be able to figure out whether they were in church or in a seminary classroom or in an organizing meeting. If you couldn't actually tell the difference, then we were doing our work right. And that was the experience of a lot of folk. But as I mentioned, it was really difficult to sustain. First of all, by moving it around from place to place and having to sort of organize from scratch in each place. How do you build partnerships on the ground with these different places so that the school is actually contributing to change work there rather than draining it? But we also found that we got almost no buy-in from denominations or from seminaries, including seminaries in cities where we went, with a few exceptions like Barbara and Memphis Theological Seminary when we were in Memphis. Even more troubling to my point of view, very few of the faith-based activist organizations bought in. We actually thought we could be the seminary for the Pax Christis and the community organizing networks, and and that just didn't turn out to be the case for a lot of reasons, not least of which is activist culture, which doesn't take the time and space to reflect critically on its work. So that kind of balkanization between seminary, sanctuary, and streets has been the problem we're trying to overcome, but also the problem that is difficult to overcome. We've tried mentorship models. We've got a few folk here who are part of the mentoring program, a year-long mentoring program. We're trying online kinds of things. There was just a Word in World gathering in Detroit this summer that looked at it was a threefold dialogue between Christian activists, hip-hop organizers, and Native activists. So that was the first time we tried something that was, in fact, not sort of one faith stance, but actually a quite diverse community. And it's been challenging, and I think over these 15 years, I am probably coming more to Jin's view that the real transformation happens with deep, hands-on, extended, nurturing, mentoring
sort of old-style apprenticeship models. But how do we do that in a highly mobile society, and how do we do that in a way that doesn't become exclusive in its smallness? Those are issues we're really looking at. These are the right questions to be asking, but the answers are not obvious. And this is a very urgent conversation. So I'll hand it to Jin, and then maybe we can open this up.
I talked about our seminary a little earlier. We are 1 year, 1 month into it, and it's one of the most fun things I've ever done. And I'm so blessed to work with two amazing colleagues. Laura and John are both co-founders, and John has put together just one of the most outstanding curriculum. We're reading incredible books and learning from a wide array of some of the most innovative and free-thinking people, not just in the theological world, but in economics and politics and history. So it's just most of the texts where the three of us leaders are reading for the first time ourselves. And our reading pace is the same as a student's. So if we assign a lot, then we suffer too. So it's a really amazing thing for the leaders and the students to read the same text at the same time, at the same pace, and then wrestle with it together the next morning. And that's just been so much fun. So we have top-notch material we're dealing with. And Laura provides so much amazing intuition and emotional intelligence, and she shapes the feel of our seminary, and our whole seminary is student-geared. No matter how brilliant my ideas are, and there are many, if it doesn't get traction with the students, then who cares? You know, so we're constantly seeing what's working with our students. Is there healing? Is there growth? Is there transformation? Is there metanoia and conversion happening among our students? Then we need to press on with that. But no matter what we come up with in our weekly meetings, if it's not working, we just have to chuck it. So that's been fun to just invent this as we go along every day. So we're caught in that dilemma that I think Chet described very well, which is there is such an urgent need for the resources of this ancient text, the Bible, to be understood in our world, and for what we're learning, the exciting and dynamic things that we're learning, to be shared more broadly. So we feel that urgency, and we care about the whole world, of course, and we care about the Church of Jesus Christ, and we're very committed to the ecumenical movement. But how do we do what we're doing and not have the salt lose its saltiness, right? It's our immersion and life together experience that gives us the deep insights in the first place, that gives us our radical edge, that allows us to experience the things that we're experiencing. So that balance between doing our small thing and then sharing that with the world is something we haven't figured out yet. And we've had some great ideas over a three-day retreat with Elaine and Chad over the last 3 days. But we really are trying not to lose our saltiness and feel that this immersive experience is really important, because empire is just that deeply embedded in our bones. And we really, there's a lot of good analysis out there. We're really looking for transformation. As I said earlier, at the molecular level at this point, and see what happens with that.
There's a lot that's been shared, but I also want to provide a chance to see what's resonating with your spirits, what you're wrestling with, and to have a chance to open up this conversation a little bit. So we have a mic in the center here. If you do have a question, a comment, want to carry this conversation forward a certain direction, please come up to the mic, tell us your name, where you're from, what community, and just keep it to one question so we can get as many folks as we will. And we'll try to end around 9 o'clock or so tonight. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Jim Bear Jacobs. member of the Mohican Nation and a pastor on staff here at Church of All Nations. As a Native American, I am used to being overlooked even by those who are seeking diversity. And understanding that your ability to have your institutions and your buildings is itself a net benefit of a colonizing empire, I'm wondering in your work to decolonize theology, how you engage Native American and Indigenous voices and what insights you glean from those.
Those of you with buildings can answer.
Pico is not a building, but Pico is in many ways a reflection of the communities that we've chosen to engage. And so there are a number of blind spots, I think, in our work, particularly as it relates to our engagement with the API community, real engagement with the African American community, and increasingly, particularly in places like California and Minnesota, and New Mexico and Arizona, more and more we find ourselves engaging. As soon as we start thinking more broadly about our work, we start discovering all these folks we've been overlooking. And one of the big lessons for us in our work is to recognize that we have not created any kind of space to figure out how we engage Indigenous spirituality in the conversation about a theology of resistance, if you will. And so that's a brand new conversation that we're unfolding with a number of our Indigenous leaders in the PICO network. But we are so young in that conversation and being very disrupted by it.
Well, we have lots of buildings, and decolonization is a lot harder than one might think. It isn't your goodwill or your heart that makes it work. And often in the effort, you create other issues. We have spent most of our lives building things for other people without asking them what they wanted. So when I came to United, they told me they had done a lot of work back in the 70s with Native communities and First People. But that was then, and then there was this long gap where our neighbors here in Minnesota, we have many, many First Peoples who are neighbors. Nothing's been done. And so what I'm doing is proceeding very carefully and very slowly and creating partnerships and listening to the people and asking them how we can help them or how we can be of service or how we can decolonize or what is needed by this organization. Because we come with arrogance. It's very, very difficult to shed what we've gathered over the years. And so we're doing partnerships and we're listening to people and we'll create what's wanted.
How I would address that question is first by recognizing that the conventional church, and by the way, Church Foundations is part of the Presbyterian Church USA. I mean, it can't get more conventional mainline Protestant than that, and except Lutherans. And it's kind of ideology based, you know. A nicer term for ideology in the church is theology, but we have our ideologies and form tribes around it. What we're trying to do at Church Foundations is understand history, like how things were, and also prehistory before writing, the history of people before this centralized civilizational framework, the history of Indigenous peoples throughout the world to this very day, which is often goes unnoticed unless you search really hard. So we're seeing indigeneity as the backdrop out of which civilizational empire arose. What did our society look like then? What do Indigenous societies look like even to this day, who have not, in many ways, been molested too much by empires. And is there something that the Bible is saying about that? Is it really just an imperial text, or is there a counter-imperial narrative throughout? People like Chet and Barbara and others have been writing and speaking and teaching about those things for decades, and we are noticing that that strain more and more. And really, we really think it's at the heart of these ancient texts. So rooting our present reality, our analysis in history rather than ideology is helping us to see just how important First Nations peoples are in helping us get a grip on reality. And that's what I think a lot of us at Church of All Nations understanding is that theology is really just ideology, which is ultimately unreality. And we can read the Bible that way, and the Western Church has been very good at that for the last 1,700 years. But there is another way to read the scriptures that I think get us at our true humanity. And so the indigenous framework, indigenous voices, indigenous interpretation even of things like the Bible are, I would say, increasingly important to our church and to our seminary. But we have a long ways to go as well.
Jim Baer, it seemed in pushing to revision pedagogy as place-based, which is a real paradigm shift for Western education. And that, by the way, if any of you aren't already signed up for the weekend conference starting tomorrow, really invite you to join us. That's really going to be the heart of the conversation we're going to have over the next 48 hours. it seems to me, and this is what we're experimenting with in our bioregion in traditional Chumash land in California, is that when pedagogy begins and ends in the places we dwell, then having to encounter, not just learn about, but encounter somatically, psychically, spiritually, politically, economically, the peopled history of that place, not only inevitably means one must encounter indigenous peoples and their story, but it begins with it. It must begin with that. That's actually the foundation of pedagogy, if it's place-based, because that's where the story begins, the story of that peopled story of that place, in fact, begins. And so that actually gives privileges the story. But it's not sort of indigeneity in the abstract, nor is it exoticism. It's this people who dwelled here, and who actually figured out how to dwell here sustainably, which then means we've got all kinds of stuff to learn from them, not just about them. And it also has to deal with the wounds and the legacies of violence and violation, and it means that the agenda of restorative justice, whether or not the people of that place are still there or in whatever form or remnant they are still there, it demands that people of that place ground the pedagogy there. So it's my hope, as someone who's really been struggling with that very issue in for alternative theology, because while I was in seminary, actually I was doing solidarity work with indigenous people around the Pacific Basin, and so for me that was kind of like what community organizing was for you. That was for me at that time. So it's always been haunted my imagination, and I do believe that a place-based pedagogy, to say we begin here, and that means we begin listening to the voices of this place, both past and present, that are the traditional stewards of the land, means that we just cannot avoid it.
which most of the other pedagogical models seem to enable us, if not to avoid it, then to marginalize it, or, you know, we'll get to it at some point, or, you know, we've been there, we've done that, you know. So that's one of my hopes, just as a strategy, that place-based pedagogy would require that sort of ongoing encounter with indigenous voices, and then we are dealing with all the various layers and strata of immigration, voluntary and not, and settlement and colonization and so on. So maybe we have time for somebody else. Yes.
My name is Bethany Ringdahl, and this should be Rich. I'm in my first month of my formal seminary education at Luther Seminary with plans to be ordained in the ELCA. So,
quick, call the medics.
Right. So the question is, for those of us who are young, who feel a strong and passionate sense of call to do the work of God for the people of God, and who believe that the church has a lot of work to do in terms of being converted back to what the kingdom of God looks like, but also who have, like, you know, bills to pay and stuff like that, like real people do, what do you recommend? Ready, set, go.
Is the question specifically around the sort of economic reality of seminary, or... Maybe take one more crack at it, if you would.
So is, like, getting a Master of Divinity from a seminary, like, worth it? And if not, how does one go about having this sort of career in the church without being, stuck in all the bad stuff?
Well, that's a great question. Let me start, and we'll see how we do on that. I spend a lot of my time in conversation with young folk like yourself who say, should I go to seminary? And I spend most of my time trying to talk people out of it, just quite honestly. And that's kind of sad to say, but just from my perspective, I feel like there are just too many contradictions. However, I am interested in the conversation on what basis would one go to seminary? How would one go to seminary? And I think questions like, do you have a practical skill to support yourself so that you are never completely dependent on a pension-driven, politically-driven job that prevents you from following your conscience? Or, for that matter, following a social movement that is demanding something of you, even better. That's real. That's one of the things that domesticates the voice of clergy, is they're fearful for their jobs and their pensions. And they are rightly fearful because they're in a very fragile, anxious system, as Jin would call it. So have something in the way of a day job as insurance. That would be one piece of advice. The second piece of advice is have a community of accountability outside the seminary, preferably rooted in a community, preferably rooted in a marginalized community, that you are accountable to not only in making the decision to go, but that you are sent from and that you presumably will return to. And throughout the journey, there's a sense of accountability. Those are two things that are much harder to do than to say. But I think they make the difference. I used to say, do it part-time and do something like community organizing or service work or art, as a way of trying to remain in balance. It's many seminarians will tell you seminary is the most spiritually difficult time of their lives, and it's important that you figure out how to nurture yourself through there. It's much more difficult now to tell students to go part-time because of the demands of the political economy of education. And I don't have a great answer to that.
It is my hope, as someone who actually has my foot more firmly in the non-credentialed world of alternative theological education, that those of us who have been trying to pioneer these alternative models and those folks in the existing institutional seminaries can figure out how to partner better so that the lines can be a little more, what's the word I'm looking for, porous, and folk can go in and out. That's difficult, but that's beginning to happen as seminaries, I think, are awakening to the fact that a lot of folk have been out there trying to experiment with this, and there's, you know, there's the experience of organizing, the experience of multicultural pastoring, that has got to have as much credibility as just academic degrees. So the more holistic model, I think, ultimately will be partnerships across the academic divide. That would be my hope, and that would be good news for a student like you, because it would be a lot easier for you to have a variety of experiences in your seminary education if we could figure out how to do those partnerships. What do you reckon?
I don't have anything to add. I was wondering, though, would you say that also the change, like the demands of the emerging constituency, also require seminaries to rethink? To rethink all those pieces around the porousness of the alternative and
Well, I sell MDivs, so.
You sell what?
MDivs.
Out of the back.
Master
of
Master of Divinity degrees. So yeah, I think you should probably get one. But my guess is that you were not called to seminary. You were called with a passion for something. And that you're in seminary to learn more to support the passion. So my advice to you is not to disappear into the vortex of seminary esotericism. But remember the passion that brought you there, the elders that guided the way so that you could find your way there, so that you can sprinkle breadcrumbs and find your way back out.
I also find myself dissuading people more and more from going to seminary. At least when I went to seminary, if you went to kind of a relatively rich school, you could really go for free. So if they're just going to give you 3 years of free seminary, then why not, right? But it's so different now. And there are still a few schools, like the one I went to, that have a $1 billion endowment. But otherwise, I mean, we're looking at serious debt. And the other thing is that, like in my denomination, the Presbyterian Church USA, when I started, I think we had maybe like 15,000 congregations. I think we're down to like 9,000 right now. When I was first ordained, we probably had close to 3 million members. Right now, we're like at 1.7 million members, and we're losing 100,000 members a year, okay? When it comes to membership loss, we're number one. So, take note. I'm sorry, I still have some habits of triumphalism. But anyway, I mean, like, we're seriously going to have zero members in 17 years. We will still have our board of pensions because Presbyterians are really good at money. And we will have our, you know, foundation and benevolence fund and all kinds of other institutions. I mean, the Presbyterian Church institutionally will outlast everyone else. I have no doubt about that. Hundreds of years. We're so good at bureaucracy. But in terms of being a living church, we have a very brief shelf life. So I'm ordained in the Presbyterian Church USA. Those of you who know anything about ordination process know that the PCUSA has pretty rigorous standards. More rigorous than many. So it's a pretty, you know, neat thing, and you feel a little bit elitist when you get that. But, like, what is the big, fat, hairy deal, ultimately? And the way that I'm going, it's not difficult to imagine a defrocking at some point, right? So I have to count that cost, and say, is my validation as a pastor of God's people coming from this denomination that will have zero members in 17 years? You know, what is that, right? And my degrees and things like that. So we have to think about the credibility of our educating and ordaining institutions in the first place. Like, how credible are they really? And why does, like, the ATS, Association of Theological Schools, the major national accrediting body, have godlike powers to determine that one is credible and legitimate and others are not? Who gave these people that kind of power to validate and legitimate the people of God? So I say to Empire, you are nothing. And I say to ATS, you are nothing. And Jesus said, by their fruits ye shall know them, right? So you produce your fruit, and we'll produce ours, and let God decide, and let the people decide the kind of impact and change and growth that they are experiencing. So if we really have a passion for ministry, which is to care for people and to liberate them, and that means not just liberating them from imperial poverty so that they can have imperial wealth. That's just one form of enslavement to another. But true liberation, right? To set the captives free, to have the blind see, and the deaf hear, and the lame walk, the ministry that Jesus did, then how are we going to be captive to imperial ecclesiastical systems, and then do the ministry of Jesus after that? So, like I said, I feel hypocritical because I've done all that and benefited greatly, and I've had a great life. And also, just to be honest, I mean, I get a full-time salary from this church, and our people support our ministry financially enough that I can have a full-time salary. It's great. I'm so glad I don't have to be a barista on the side. You know, because I don't even like coffee that much. Or anything else. I mean, it's so wonderful. I love being a pastor more than anything in the whole world. I mean, it's just the most wonderful, fun, joyful, exciting. It's just awesome. And that's why we had an internship program for so many years. I loved it so much. And I'm a natural evangelist. I want to, like, pull everybody I can and say, do this, because it's just the greatest thing in the whole world to be a pastor to the people of God. And even the suffering and the heartaches and the headaches and the complaining and all that is worth it, because that's part of the package. But it's such a wonderful thing. But that kind of, those churches are disappearing. And if we get ordained and credentialed, and then go out there, we're basically playing musical chairs with one another. The seminaries need to keep up their enrollment to keep things going. They got to keep the buildings going. They got to keep the administration and the faculty going. They have to keep up enrollment to keep that thing going. There's an internal logic to it. But the churches are declining and dying. And those churches that used to have associates only have a single pastor. And those who used to have single pastor go to half-time pastor, and a third-time pastor, a quarter-time pastor, and then a commissioned lay pastor, and not ordained people. And so we're graduating and then playing musical chairs with one another, and the most elite among us maybe lands in a chair for a while until that church declines and pushes us out. So do we really want to get in on that game right now? Or do we have a vision for something else? Because the people are voting with their feet, and they're saying that the church as usual is not something that is compelling and important and urgent enough for them to support. And I think that's going to be the case at Church of All Nations too. I feel pretty strongly that we too are not going to, we're not going to escape those social forces in America. And the people, especially the millennial generation, are looking for something more than weekly church attendance and some social justice work and some evangelistic work and fellowship and stuff. So we also have to prepare for that day. I also have to figure out what to do beyond congregational pastoral ministry if I want to continue to lead the people of God. But to ask those questions right up front is so much better than to wait 20 years into it and scramble to try to make a life you've made for decades to keep that going, because that's really stressful. So I'm grateful that I have an incredible wife and family and church that will support all kinds of alternative ways of living for us and for the congregation. So we're not afraid of salary cuts, loss of building, loss of ordination. I mean, we've thought this through, and we have a community here that's going to be together through thick and thin. Creating that kind of community and ministering within that kind of context, I think, is, I can't think of anything more worthwhile. But how to get from denominational, you know, ordination, credentialing, education to that is a huge leap. I don't know exactly how to get there, but those are the questions we're asking here. Please.
So I just spent 6 years in seminary myself, to your point. But part of me being here, well, not part, but a great part of me being here this weekend is to detoxify and deconstruct all of the notions of whiteness that was placed on me with those Lutherans. I mean, so we had this celebration of biblical preaching at the seminary, which I was there as an alumni, thank you, Lord. And for the first time to hear preachers talk about how to preach the gospel. And it's a clear distinction how African-Americans read the Bible and how white people read the Bible. You think we are reading from two different books, how we interpret and translate and put it out there. So I started out as an MDiv student, to your point. And Dr. Holmes, I had to drop out of the MDiv program because I was like, these white people are messing my preaching up. So I stepped out and entered into an MA program. I get to preach as much as any preacher in this city because you know where I preach? In the coffee shops. So thank you guys, because I already feel like you're helping me. I told Catherine that as we were driving over here. I said, between Dr. Jen Kim and Dr. Barbara and Chad, I read your stuff on Facebook and all this stuff. And I've heard a lot about Michael Ray. Is it Michael Ray? Yeah, from the Lutherans in St. Paul. That's, you know, Isaiah converts. So I'm happy to be here.
Amen. Thank you.
I'm Kelly Chapman. I'm a pastor, pastor of Redeemer Lutheran Church in North Minneapolis. I was thinking about priest, prophet, voice. And for African Americans and people of color, I mean, the reality is church is institution. And historically, it has been a place of voice from which prophets have a platform. When Isaiah organizes, clergy put on their collars. And so I just don't want to... also, I went to seminary right out of college, lasted a year, and then 10 years of social ministry in Washington, D.C. with the Community for Creative Nonviolence. So to me, it's a place of discomfort to talk like the church and the institution doesn't have any relevance, and I don't know if I'd say it's idealistic or whatever, but to be a voice on behalf of people, until something else emerges, I believe that we need prophets, priests, and people who will claim that voice on behalf of a community.
Amen.
Hi, I'm Grace. I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, in a Christian intentional community, and I work at an Episcopal church as a youth minister, middle and high school students, and as the Episcopal campus minister at the University of Virginia. And one of my mentors within my denomination is this really radical, awesome nun, Sister Helena Marie, and sometimes she says to me, Grace, I can be right, but I don't have to be self-righteous. So I wonder how y'all navigate the murky waters between thinking / knowing you're right and not being self-righteous.
We're just about out of time.
Yeah. I think we're out of time. I think that question is also known as entrapment. Like, no matter what we say, we're going to be in trouble.
If you live long enough, you know you don't know anything. And so you lead very carefully. There is a way in which formal seminaries have become almost like ghost institutions. And what I mean by that is that they are not located in the context where they're located. They all kind of look like Yale, sort of. They all kind of look like Princeton. And if they don't, they want to be that. There's a kind of self-righteousness, institutionalized self-righteousness, because they're all copying one another. And if you look in the Bible, you see none of the prophets are the same. They have different messages, different calls. So what we're trying to do is tie the seminary to where they are geographically, serve the people who are there, and be attentive to the voices and the educational delivery systems that will work where you are. In Memphis, I turned it into Dirty South, hip-hop, urban God talk, the theodicy of Willie Nelson. There we were in the Delta. Why were we pretending we were Yale? And here in the Twin Cities, with the greatest number of immigrants, First Peoples, this is an intercultural, interfaith, inter-everything opportunity that I'm going to try to help United take.
Thanks for both of those probing comments. And it's my feeling that in trying to birth something different, we just can't draw hard lines between emerging alternatives in existing institutions. Things actually are more organic than that. It doesn't mean we can't say hard things or pose hard questions to ourselves. We have to do that. But in the actual organizing, and I want to hear what Michael Reyes says about this, the organizing task is about building alliances and building partnerships and trying to cross the often hard institutional lines that that inhibit those sorts of collaborations. And in the organizing task, self-righteousness doesn't have anything to do with it's useless. We've got to figure out what our common cause is, who our allies are, and work from that. But when inevitably in the birthing of new things, there's going to be the perception that anybody who starts something alternative is somehow judging the existing institutions. And it can get polarized on both sides. you would be interested, Pastor. I think at the end of this month I'll be in North Carolina, where one of the most interesting faith-based social movements has been percolating now for a number of years, called the Moral Monday Forward Together Movement, led by Reverend William Barber of the NAACP. So this is a social movement that's been deepening and broadening now. It's got real feet. It's being led by the black churches. It's a big tent on social and political issues. But the question internal to that movement, Michael Ray, is we need a long-term strategy of educating and re-educating our clergy and our denominational leaders about how to be church as social movement, because we didn't learn about that in seminary. And so how can we do that continuing education as we are continuing to be pastors and denominational leaders and community organizers? And so there's going to be Reverend Barber, and if you're not familiar with the movement, make yourselves familiar with it, because it's one of the most significant things happening on the American landscape right now, I think. There's going to be a gathering to talk about an alternative seminary for that movement. But it's very specific in how to build capacity within that movement. Because as important as the Black Church has been institutionally to amplifying the voice of marginalized people, and it has been, there's a stuckness there as well. And I think this movement is about trying to reboot the moral imagination of the Black Church in that context, and trying to cross-fertilize with social movements. And so it's really not about will the church as an institution be here or should it be here. It's here. It's going to be here for a while. Let's do what we can to animate and mobilize those resources. And let's also not wait to explore alternatives as our churches, you know, fiddle while Ferguson burns. So both of those imperatives, I think, are true, and that's why I believe that we need to be moving back and forth in those spaces. Michael Ray.
I guess just two things. I think I may have already said this. So, you know, the frame we've been using with our project that we're launching next year is a movement from encounter to disruption to reimagination and action. And I think that as relates to self-righteousness and being right, our experiences of late, particularly as we've continued to invest our time and resources in paying attention to issues around immigration and mass incarceration, has been that we're working with constituencies that typically haven't been in the congregations that we've organized historically. And there's just so much humility that we have to bring to those encounters with folks. And we're disrupted in so many ways. We can't ask, we can't tell people they have to take their caps off or, you know, pull their pants up or, you know, like all that, like there's like so many things that we have to rethink and operate with a spirit of humility and a willingness to learn and really understand and connect with each other. And that's what the encounter is all about. I guess the other, I'm not really sure what the self-righteous question was sort of thinking about, but I thought about how many times I said, are you a chaplain to the empire or a prophet of the resistance? And I'm reminded of how many times I ask that question and a clergy person tells me I'm being self-righteous or being unfair or being binary in asking that question. I mean, it's really just a strategy, right, to try to, you know, to polarize it and get people to think in between the two poles and kind of get clear about what their orientation and what their priorities and values are. But one comment that comes up a lot of times around that question is, I don't appreciate the question because there's more to what I do than just justice work. I care for people. I provide, you know, pastoral care and counseling. I lead and plan worship and celebration. And so then my question is, I'm still asking you the same question. Are you a chaplain to the empire, prophet of the resistance? At the end of the day, our justice work is not just the work we do out in the communities. Our justice work happens in the worship and celebration. Our justice work happens in the pastor's office when we're providing care for people in our congregation. If at the end of the day you aren't counseling someone to help them find their liberation, why are you counseling them? And if we're not worshiping in a way that's going to help us really get free, because that's all those young people out in the streets want to do, they want to get free, then what are we doing? And so I appreciate the question because there are many ways in which this moment has been one of disruption, and there are ways in which you've sort of taken sides. But there is a spirit of humility that has to be a part of this journey as well.
I appreciate as with the other panelists, the comments that Pastor Kelly and Grace just presented. I agree that life is not binary. It's not either or. However, I am Korean, and that means that hyperbole is a very integral part of how we speak. I use hyperbole all the time. Get it? Okay. And it's very much a literary strategy in the Bible as well. It's not very popular in the kind of Enlightenment rational framework, the Kantian ways in which we've learned to speak here in the modern West. But hyperbole, is very much used in the Bible. So I've schooled myself intentionally in the language and the literary methodology of the scriptures. So if people who visit and listen to like one sermon I preach are regularly offended and scandalized, you have just have to stay here for really years to hear the whole story. But I personally don't feel the need to justify any one particular thing at one particular time. Jesus says, anybody who is with us is not against us. What's the saying?
You said it both ways, right?
Yeah. Somebody help me here. Exactly. Right. And in one context, he says it one way. In another context, he says it another way. So I also am a provocateur to try to get us, you know, wedged out of the habits of empire. But I serve as an adjunct faculty at one of our denominational seminaries. I just spoke at another one a few weeks ago and had a really warm time. And my wife and I have never failed in over 20 years to give annual pledge to our seminary, even though they have $1 billion-plus endowment, because we got free education there. We loved our time at Princeton and continue to believe in its mission and believe in a both-and strategy. So we support the work of Luther Seminary and Bethel Seminary and United Seminary, and when we are asked to help in whatever way, we help. Because we believe that we need every avenue possible. No avenue is perfect. So we fully affirm that call to do all that we can in the spaces that we have. A few of us have been called to try something new, even if it doesn't work, to at least innovate and try and see if it might fire up some imagination and help us enter into some new practices that might be helpful. So the Grace's comment about humility, I think, is not thinking that the new thing is the best thing. That can easily devolve into a fetish for novelty. And those who are regularly starting new things and creating new things and trying new things can fall into that. So I think that is a helpful reminder. For those of us who consider ourselves part of the radical movement, it is a good reminder to us whether what we're doing is really new or really old, and it's probably both, but we appreciate that word from both of you. It's 9:00. I'm going to hand the microphone back to Laura.
Thank you to all of you sharing your wisdom and your experience and your courage with all of us. Really appreciate this time we've had together, and for all of you for coming and being a part of the conversation and a part of the experiment. Just want to point you to a couple of things. There are some resources in the back that Ted brought along, some books and other things that are for sale, some really, really good work. So take a look back there if you get a chance. There's also some information on Underground Seminary, which is the experiment that we're doing here. We're opening up our next cohort about a year from now. We'll have space for about 6 students, so more information about what we're up to, and that next group is in the back as well. And as Ted mentioned, we do have a conference coming up. A lot of you are here for that. It's starting tomorrow afternoon, and it will go through the weekend. So our theme is Identity, Theology in Place, Reinhabiting the Mississippi Watershed. If you'd like more information about that or want to register for it, please see me after and it can get you connected. Oh, and yeah, Chad Myers will be preaching here at Cannes on Sunday, so if you want to come back for that, please do stop in. So at this time, I'd like to invite Pastor David, where is Pastor David, to give us a closing prayer. Pastor David is one of our pastors here at Church of All Nations.
Can we all stand up for closing prayers?
You should remind people that you also teach at United Seminary.
I also teach at United. She is my boss. I'm an adjunct there. So let's pray. Gracious God, you called us with a calling. You are calling us, you called us, and you also sent us out. to where the people are, where there is pain and joy. We pray that you give us a double portion of your Spirit, that as we walk and do, as we touch and talk, we may be you doing that. Give us a good night, even as we drive home. Give us a good weekend. Give us a good year. Be with us now and even forevermore. For we pray this in your name. Amen. Amen. And amen.